Precio asequible. Descúbrelo llamando al 911-333-5833 o en grupobaugan.com.
I have personally taught 2,000 people. I have supervised the teaching of more than 50,000. I know what works, and I know what doesn't work. The secret is the motivation of the student. It's the student who learns the language. It's the student who solves the problem. However, the catalyst, el culpable del bien, is the Vaughan method and the Vaughan teacher. We transform the student into our accomplice, nuestro cómplice. Cómplice en el crimen de aprender inglés de verdad.
Estás escuchando Vaughan Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization. From Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. And on this program, I would like to talk about some of the poetry that was coming out during the transition between the Roman Republic and the civil wars that followed. And then finally, the Augustan Age, the Empire. The time of the first emperor and an unprecedented moment of peace. On earlier programs, I talked about poets at that time. I talked about Virgil. I talked about Horace. And then on my last program, I began to talk about Ovid. And on this program, I'd like to continue speaking about Ovid. I talked about Ovid as a 20-year-old, as a very young man. Publius Ovidius Naso, born outside of Rome, born in the mountains, born, 150 kilometers east of Rome, but raised in Rome, raised as a Roman, raised in a generation that did not know war. In other words, earlier poets had been deeply affected by the Civil War and by what Rome had become during the Civil War. And so you had a poet, for example, like Horace, talking about turning his back on Rome and turning his back on city life, right? A complete break with everything that Rome had represented up until that point, everything Rome had stood for. The kind of things that had made Rome great, because people were dreaming of fame and fortune in the big city and of making themselves and their descendants proud because of the prestige, the reputation of, for example, building a great monument and being a public benefactor of the city. That monument would have your name on it, and everybody would remember with gratitude, generation after generation, all your descendants would benefit from this, that you had been the person who allowed this to be constructed, that was all because of you. A monument, a fountain, a theater, a temple, built because of you. And then all of a sudden you have a person like Horace saying, no, get out of the city. City life is no good. What you want to do is lie down under the shade of an oak tree, un roble, and listen to the el arroyo, listen to the brook or, well, in the United States, a creek, and allow that noise to put you to sleep, take a rest, take a nap, and nothing is finer than to live out in the countryside. Now, you have a new generation represented by Ovid, who is urban, but light and witty, right? Ocurrente. And his prose is, scintillating. It's sparkling. And his style is irreverent. Remember that back in the times of Virgil, for example, or Horace, both of them knew the Civil War. And both of them were horrified by that war and its consequences, deeply affected. And both of them were eternally grateful to Augustus and the new style, right? Solemnity, protocol, dignity, a decorum. Whereas Ovid is just the opposite. Ovid is irreverent. And on my last program, I was talking about the kinds of things he was writing when he was in his 20s, which are identical to what you see today out in the streets of the center of Madrid, with people coming out of after hours in early on a Saturday or Sunday morning, looking like zombies, but feeling, well, Ovid says that he can spend the night, you know, enjoying himself, and then come out in the morning fit, strong, composed. Then he talks about this this older woman that he has taken as a lover, and how he gets into her house, convincing the slave that if the slave denounces him, if the slave tells on him, right, that the master would never believe that his wife would be capable of this, and the only person who would get hurt would be the slave himself. There's no use in telling the master what his wife has done. If it's her word against yours, you will get whipped, right? Flagelado. Or azotado. And then later on, he sees that his mistress, Corina, is her name, that Corina is starting to do things that he hasn't taught her. She must have learned them from another lover. In other words, he is not alone. He and her husband are not the only people that she is having sex with. And this is a great disappointment to him. But of course, he treats all of this with irony. And he's ironic about practically everything. It reminds me a little bit of Oscar Wilde, who said that serious things should be treated with complete frivolity, right? The most serious things in life should be talked about as if they were the most frivolous. On the other hand, the trivial things, the frivolous things in life, they should be treated very, very seriously. And that is one of his secrets to living well, and quite possibly one of his secrets of success. Because most people really admire when the world is upside down like that. When serious things are treated in a trivial way, and trivial things are treated in a serious way. And so, one of his poems is called The Art of Love. He wrote this in about the year 1 BCE, before the Common Era, right? Antes de Cristo. Now, he is talking about ways of seducing women, and he himself admits that he can... Well, again, like the famous quote of Oscar Wilde, that he can resist anything except temptation, and that he is a sucker. That's modern slang. Sucker, muy susceptible, right? I'm a sucker for this, or I'm a sucker for that. Sucker is normally the equivalent of como un pringao. But to be a sucker for is to be very, very susceptible to something. So yes, I'm a sucker for you, something like that. The so he's a sucker for all kinds of women, tall or short, big or little, a blonde or dark, blonde or brunette. Let's put it that way: blonde or brunette, fair or dark. Fair is also, well, for example, in with weather, despejado, right? A fair sky, fair weather. And in this case, fair como pálido. So yes, all kinds of women. And he, in The Art of Love, he is giving advice to a student, to a novice, from an expert, about how to get a mistress. And, for example, do not seduce a woman at a banquet because there the wine and the fact that you're in the triclinium, right? The light is probably bad, illumination by candlelight. You will not be able to see exactly what you're getting. Now, he also gives advice to women. And, well, talking about the romantic combat, well, metaphorically, referring to the gladiatorial games, he says that Venus's gladiator, right, Venus's boy, fights upon the sand, but the spectator with the woman by his side is also touching her hand and asking for the program, inquiring who is winning, placing his bet. He is being wounded just as the person they are watching, fighting in the arena, is being wounded. Or, for example, using a metaphor of the battlefield, when talking about seduction, saying that the tacticians recommend a night attack and catching the enemy when the enemy is asleep. To exploit a sleeping husband with a vigorous attack while the enemy is snoring, right? To snore, roncar. And yes, he definitely recommends that to keep things civil between lovers, that they should pretend, think he. In other words, the man always has to find the woman attractive, no matter what she is wearing or no matter how she looks. And a woman should always pretend that she is absolutely captivated by what the man is saying, no matter how dull, whether he is repeating himself. So you can imagine how popular all of this might have been back then. Everybody wanted to read it, everybody talking about it, and how this went so against the spirit of the times that Augustus was so interested in fomenting, right? Because at this time, Augustus wanted people to, first of all, to get married. There was a fine to pay if you were not married, a little like in ancient Sparta. What Augustus was trying was that there would be some kind of humiliation to people who were not married and procreating. Right? Because that was an important part of it. The idea that you would get married in order to procreate, in order to create new Romans. And that all of this would have to be taken with the utmost, right? With maximum, utmost, with the utmost seriousness. And here, you're just absolutely irreverent and light and witty and scintillating and laughing at everything, laughing at sex itself. And Augustus, you can imagine, he was shocked. He was personally offended. And when Ovid heard this, he tried to write something that would, undo his reputation as a bad boy. He wrote The Cures of Love, another didactic poem, but in this case, sort of recanting, undoing, saying he's sorry, and that the cure for love is, law, war, politics. If you're really unhappy in love, well, you avoid solitude, you go out and try and have fun, but the best thing, the best way out of unhappy love is through work. But of course, this was not nearly enough, and Ovid at this time understood that he had an enemy in the emperor. No less a figure than the emperor himself was keeping an eye on Ovid. But that didn't stop Ovid from writing his greatest work, The Metamorphoses. And The Metamorphoses, coming down to us, it has been the inspiration for artworks ever since. You cannot go from room to room in the Prado without seeing references to The Metamorphoses. These are stories based on the old tales, based on the Greek myths that everybody knew back then, but they are given a completely new form. It's impossible to study the history of art without knowing The Metamorphoses, right? It's required reading if you take art history. You really have to. And it's an interesting read. It's a fun read. It's light. Back in its time, it represented a complete break with everything Ovid had been doing previously. First, he had been writing about sort of everyday life. He had been writing about things that Romans were completely familiar with and that were practicing themselves. This was mythology. And it was written in hexameters rather than what he usually did. But the surprising thing about it is how exhaustive it is. I mean, there's more than 250 references to different anecdotes, different myths, legends, folk stories. And what they have in common is the transformation. Usually with some kind of divine intercession, mortals are transformed into something different. Human beings are transformed, metamorphosized into something that they that is not human anymore. And we're talking about animals, we're talking about plants, we're talking about minerals, objects. People change, the world changes. The very first one we talk about is the metamorphosis from chaos, right? This primeval chaos. In the beginning, there was chaos, and it was transformed. Just like in the Bible. By the way, in the Bible, they're really bad translations saying that God created the earth. That is the way they have translated it, but that's not the way it is in the original, right? In the original, it's very clear that the universe was there before God, which is the way it was in every other prehistoric story about how life came about, right? Every creation story, it's never from nothing. Story after story, it's always about how there is chaos, and then there is divine intercession, and after that, there is order. And this is also true of the biblical story. In any case, when we're talking about Ovid, we talk about both what changes and what remains the same. Persistence and transformation, right? The individuals who become something else generally retain their identities, or quite often they are transformed into something that is more appropriate to their personalities. For example, a man who acts like a wolf is transformed into a wolf. A woman, Daphne, who is determined to resist Apollo, is transformed into a tree, successfully able to resist Apollo. Or people who fight all the time, transformed into frogs, right? With the croak, the of the frog. That's croar in Spanish, to croak in English. Now, speaking of the primeval chaos, right? The chaos at the beginning of the world. Well, there is nothing quite as chaotic as the metamorphosis, because all of these stories are mixed together. The style, the tone, the speed, the subject matter, you never know what's coming next, and you never know how it will be presented, but it is always amusing. It never gets boring. It's fun. Most of all, it is fun. And Ovid is successfully able to maintain that that fun throughout the narrative, all the way along, right? You don't get bored. It is never monotonous. I remember I took a course once in creative writing, in Spanish, actually. I was writing in Spanish, and the teacher, in one of the first weeks, you know, talking about characters, talking about a whole idea of what literature is made of, and the grammar of literature, that's what he called it, so that the individual characters, the personalities, that these would be comparable to the nouns. And much of the narrative, that would be comparable to verbs and the action in the story, like a verb. And one of the things, when we got to action, when we got to verbs, one of the exercises that he made us do was to speed up time, to accelerate time, and then to slow it down, to decelerate, to extend time, so that an entire year can pass in a paragraph, but then you write three pages and 3 seconds can be extended to three full pages of manuscript text. And this was a very, very worthwhile exercise, because it did show me how the narrator is capable of doing something like this. The time is just another thing you can play with. Time, space, when you are the writer, when you are the narrator, you can play with all of these things. Well, in the Metamorphoses, this is exactly what Ovid is doing. There are very lengthy descriptions of transformations, of metamorphoses, in which time seems to move very slowly. It's happening in an instant, but with extensive explanation of, well, it's almost shocking when you start to think about what is involved when the fingers turn into the fingers turn into tallos, no, the stems, and the arms into branches, and etc., etc. The result is conmovedor, right? The result is genuinely moving. Okay, I have to take a break. I'll be back in just a minute with the second part of the program.
I'm Richard Vaughan. What do you do? I teach. What do you teach? I teach English. Who do you teach? I teach Spanish people, usually, sometimes other nationalities. Why do you teach? Because it's fun. Only because it's fun? Yes, because it's fun. You sound selfish. And your students? Well, if it's fun for me, it's fun for them. It becomes contagious. The English language becomes contagious. The students become addicted, and finally, they master the language. It's a logical process. Don't you agree?
Aprende inglés desde casa por menos de 30 céntimos al día. Un año de clases por solo 99 euros. Infórmate en curso de inglés online Vaughan.com. Ya disponible también en Latinoamérica. Apúntate, curso de inglés online Vaughan.com.
¿Conoces los super eficaces Summer Impacts de Vaughan? Considéralo como un chute de inglés. ¿Y qué mejor momento que en medio del verano? Los Summer Impacts de Vaughan empiezan el 30 de mayo y van hasta el 5 de septiembre. Aprovecha este verano para ganar confianza y empezar septiembre pisando fuerte. Y puedes escoger lo que mejor te convenga, o presencial o bien por videoconferencia. Whatever floats your boat. Tenemos horarios de tarde y de mañana. Tendrás un profesor Vaughan para ayudarte con la pronunciación, vocabulario, gramática, phrasal verbs y los errores más comunes. Las clases son 100% orales y dinámicas. Make the most of this summer with Summer Impacts. Aprovecha el verano con los Summer Impacts de Vaughan. Give your English a boost. Y si te apuntas antes del 31 de mayo, recibirás un descuento de un 30%. Para más información, visita nuestra web, grupovaughan.com, o llámanos al 911-385831. Summer Impacts de Vaughan. What are you waiting for?
¿Quieres recibir clase conmigo? Pues si quieres, tienes 200 horas de clase de inglés gratis en RTVE a la carta. Ve a Google y escribe Vaughan RTVE a la carta. Y presto, ahí verás más de 370 clases de media hora y cada día se añade una más. Desde principiante hasta avanzado, te llevo por todo lo necesario de mi idioma. Píldoras potentes de inglés. También hay libros de texto que acompañan al curso, pero son opcionales. Con o sin ellos, aprenderás mucho inglés o mejorarás mucho tu dominio. Pruébalo en Google. Vaughan RTV a la carta. Ahí nos veremos.
Lo que más miedo da al profesional español es hablar por teléfono en inglés. Por eso Vaughan ha desarrollado las clases telefónicas, en las que trabajarás tanto tu comprensión auditiva como tu fluidez oral con un auténtico crack de la enseñanza. Tú eliges la hora y la temática de cada clase. Flexibilidad absoluta. Calidad Vaughan 100%. Contrata las clases telefónicas de inglés de Vaughan para tu empresa. Llama al 911-335-831 o entra en grupovaughan.com.
I have personally taught 2,000 people. I have supervised the teaching of more than 50,000. I know what works, and I know what doesn't work. The secret is the motivation of the student. It's the student who learns the language. It's the student who solves the problem. However, the catalyst, el culpable del bien, is the Vaughan method and the Vaughan teacher. We transform the student into our accomplice, nuestro cómplice, cómplice en el crimen de aprender inglés de verdad.
¿Quieres un planazo de verano para tus hijos en la ciudad? En Vaughan ya lo tenemos todo organizado para que no tengas que preocuparte por nada. Más de 10 colegios en Madrid y alrededores para que aprendan mientras se divierten en nuestros campamentos urbanos. Llama al 91 700 11 99 y te lo contamos todo.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and on the first part of the program, I was talking about Ovid, the poet Ovid. And this is, in the context of the times, the transition between the Roman Republic and the Augustan age, right? Augustus is now emperor. And he has an entire program about how he wants to change Roman society once and for all, bring back the old concepts of virtue. But at the same time, you know, after the Civil Wars, this is not very, very difficult to, well, the metaphor we often use is to get the toothpaste back into the tube. Right? It's much too late for that. And on earlier programs, I talked about Virgil, who wrote a very patriotic poem giving the Romans a chance to feel good about themselves through the Aeneas, right? How their founder, Aeneas, left Troy, traveled around the Mediterranean, stopped in Carthage, and fell in love with the Carthaginian queen, Dido, had to leave. The Carthaginians became very angry at the future Romans, giving the justification for the Carthaginian war, the Punic wars that were going to follow. In any case, Aeneas arrives in what is going to be Rome and establishes himself there, and The result makes Rome into something divinely established and permanent and something to be proud of. And yes, a great, let's call it a patriotic poem, but a wonderful work of art as well. It was supposed to be the Latin equivalent of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And Virgil trying to set himself up as the equivalent of Homer for the Greeks. And this is very ambitious, and Virgil himself wanted the Aeneid to be burned, right? When he knew he was about to die, he could see all of the mistakes he had made and so forth, and he asked that all the copies of the Aeneid be burned when he died, but fortunately they were not. In any case, this was fully in keeping with the kind of world, a post-war world, that Augustus was busy trying to impose on the Romans. Greater patriotism, decorum, gravitas, right? Solemnity, dignity, seriousness. Then on an earlier program, I also talked about Horace, who was the number two poet at this time. Horace sort of turning his back on Rome and talking about the countryside and how beautiful the countryside is, and how the countryside is the place to be, not the city, not after all that's happened. You are much better off away from Rome. Rome will only cause heartbreak, the way it did during the war. In a post-war world, you're better off in the country. Now, this marks a complete break with what had been going on previous to that. And finally, in a later generation, you do get somebody like Ovid, who is young, very urban, very ocurrente, very witty, and very irreverent. And he is going absolutely against everything that Augustus is trying to do, trying to impose on the Romans. Right? He is frivolous. It is very difficult for him to take anything seriously, much less, well, the gods, for example. He is completely irrespectful of the gods. Now, his greatest work was the Metamorphoses, and I was speaking about that just before the break. In the Metamorphoses, more than 250 different characters, and remember that all of these characters subsequently, I mean, generation after generation, artists have read the Metamorphoses. And so, painters, sculptors, even in music, you get this sort of obsession with transformation, with people who become things that are no longer human beings, but in some cases reveal quite a lot about what remains, right? Permanence as well as transformation. Sometimes the true identity of the person is only revealed after the metamorphosis takes place. Some of the portions of the metamorphosis are moving. As I mentioned just before the break, some of them are absolutely incredibly moving, conmovedor, but others are light, and the author knows how to mix these two, so that you never get bored, so that you're going from emotional to frivolous to funny. It's absolutely incredible. And it's a very, very good read. Going back to these earlier stories, I mean, in ancient Greece, you can see this in the Iliad and to a lesser degree in the Odyssey, but definitely in the Iliad. The gods are not in control of their emotions. The gods are susceptible to their own passions, right? The passions just simply run away with them. Reason is not something that human beings are expected to follow, nor are the gods. Nobody is reasonable, nobody is fair, and everybody can get angry and do stupid things. The gods do stupid things. The gods do things that later they regret, they are sorry that they had done. Now, you don't find this in, for example, in Virgil. In Virgil, the gods are much more serious. They have a sense of duty. They have their obligations that they have to fulfill. And according to the spirit of the times, there is something even superior to the gods, right? There's a destiny, there's a fate, there's something that has to happen, a prime mover. And you can see in this kind of a proto monotheistic culture, right, that very soon people are going to talk about one god. Generally, there's a transition. You know, you talk about polytheism when there are many gods, and then you talk about henotheism with an H, H-E-N-O, henotheism, when one of the gods becomes prominent, right, when a certain god becomes king of the other gods, and all of the other gods are nothing, or as I say, this is a translation, less and less compared to this superior god. And then in the end, quite often you have a monotheism in which the one god, the most powerful god, is exclusive. that there are no other gods but this one. And as I say, it's usually a transition from polytheism through henotheism to monotheism. And at this point in ancient Rome, and in most places in the world, you do have this idea that there is something above the gods that they have to answer to, that they cannot break with even if they want to. Well, Ovid kind of puts the clock back, and the gods in Ovid are funny, silly. There are many instances of injustice, divine injustice, where the gods simply want revenge. You can talk about moments of divine mercy, right, where the gods are doing the right thing and taking pity on human beings, or just the opposite, right? God wants to sleep with a mortal, and the mortal says no, and the result is punishment. The result is como despecho, right? A spite caused by sexual frustration. For example, Tiresias, in Greek times, the prophet, right, a person who has been male and female both. Tiresias is at one point taking the side of Jupiter against her husband, his wife, Juno, in the argument about who enjoys sex more, men or women. Tiresias, who has been both man and woman at one point, Tiresias says that women enjoy sex more than men do, that they have greater pleasure during the sexual act. And Juno gets offended by this, and she simply blinds, right, ciega, she blinds Tiresias. Jupiter was saying that women have more fun, and Juno was saying that women don't have so much fun. No, it's the men who are constantly thinking about sex and so forth. And Tiresias, he was 7 years. He lived 7 years as a woman. And he says that, women definitely have more fun during sex. And yeah, Juno can't hear that. She blinds him. And the whole thing about the adultery between Mars and Venus, remember that Hephaestus, or rather Vulcan, the god of the forge, the blacksmith, Herrero, he has been married to Venus, and he is her husband, her legitimate husband. And Hermes tells him that his wife is currently committing adultery. Well, what he does is he makes a net that neither of them can escape from. And he places his net, captures both of them in his net while they are making love. And the result is total humiliation. The other gods see this, and both Mars and Venus are humiliated because they have been caught. And this is in Ovid. In Ovid, one of the gods says, oh, what misfortune, right? What a misfortune happened to them. I should be so unlucky. In other words, I wish I were in Mars's situation. And the other gods simply laugh their heads off. They're roaring with laughter. The whole thing is treated in a light way, in a funny way. And, well, it is very curious that Ovid, in many cases, talking about the human beings that suffer quite a bit with these, as I say, very detailed, very lengthy descriptions of things that are going wrong. Well, he doesn't seem to be bothered by that. And some of the comments that he makes are sort of very cold-hearted, the kind of things that you would expect in a perhaps in a Hollywood movie, right? When the justiciero, when the lead comes in and the bad guy is somehow destroyed in the most horrible way, and the main character, the hero, says something sarcastic. Well, that's a little like Ovid, and that is how he invites us to contemplate these human beings who suffer these most painful and grotesque transformations. On the other hand, Ovid talks with real sympathy about, for example, animals that are sacrificed, bulls that are offered to the gods and so forth, and how they must feel. In other words, it's as if he doesn't believe any of it, right? He believes that animals have feelings, but he does not believe in the truth of the stories that he is recounting. Whereas previously, certainly in the case of Virgil, Virgil had absolute faith that what he was talking about had really happened. In other words, in the case of Aeneas, that Aeneas really lived, that Aeneas really was the son of Venus and Anchises, a mortal. There was no doubt in Virgil's mind that any of this was true. Yeah, with Ovid, again, it's fun. You know, he talks as if he's taking it seriously until he doesn't. And in many cases, it's simply absurd. For example, Narcissus. Right? Narcissus in love with his own reflection. Narcissus looking down. Narcissus is so in love that this allows Ovid to kind of satirize love poems. Right? Because you only want the best for your beloved. And you wish that your beloved has a better life than you do. Right? That long after I'm dead, my beloved will be alive and all the best for... Well, all of this, of course, is completely absurd in the case of Narcissus, who is only in love with himself. And then, of course, well, there's another one where the Cyclops, Polyphemus, is in love. And so he's preparing himself. He looks down into a pool using it as a mirror. He's practicing all of the gestures, right? The practicing, looking his best. He takes a sickle, un hoz, right? And cuts his hair and then sings to himself about... what a wonderful match he is for his beloved, in this case, Galatea, comparing her with very rustic things, saying you're like a pregnant bear. And of course, his own faults. He says, I have one eye, but so what? The sun has only one eye. And well, there are literary references also. For example, in one of Horace's poems, he talked about people doing too much, right? Gilding the lily, that's what we say. Poner sobre dorado, no? Dorar el lirio, or, well, in English, lily can also be azucena. Dorar la azucena, something like that. Doing too much. And Horace says, well, this is like the painter who can't leave it alone and has to add things compulsively. So he puts a dolphin in the woods and a boar, jabalí, in the waves. So yeah, a dolphin, un delfín en el bosque y un jabalí en las olas, las ondas. And so when Ovid is talking about a flood, inundación, naturally, he makes reference to this, that the dolphin is now in the woods and the boar is now in the waves. Or in the story where it was Argus, right? Argus of the 100 eyes. Argus had 100 eyes, and Argus was there. Juno had sent Argus to guard Io, if I remember correctly, so that Zeus would not be able to have access to her. So she's under guard. Argus is looking out, and Zeus sends Mercury. I'm sorry, Jupiter. Jupiter sends Mercury to put Argus to sleep. And Mercury traditionally does this by playing music. However, in the story by Ovid, he tells a story, a long, boring, monotonous story. And one by one, those 100 eyes begin to close. But the funny thing is that the story he's telling is practically identical to the story that Ovid has just told in the Metamorphoses, right? You're hearing this story again, but in a boring way. And this is monotonous enough to put Argus himself to sleep. And, well, one of the curious things about all this is that the author sort of insinuates himself, makes it kind of personal, right? He's there. His commentaries, his alliterations, his self-references, all of this means that you can always see Ovid behind everything, creative, pulling the strings. And, you know, when this is done badly, it is kind of vain. But when it's done right, the author's personality can provide a kind of, telón de fondo, right? A backdrop that gives more coherence to the poem as a whole. Also, one of the most curious things about this is that all of these figures, you know, from ancient times, all of them come back fresh and alive and new and understandable. And so these gods and these humans and victims of transformation, all of them are like people you might meet today. Sort of reminds me of the painting in the Spanish Baroque style. In Spanish Baroque style, because of the Council of Trent, right? The council lasting, what, almost 30 years in Trent, in the Adigio, in northern Italy. What came out of Trent was an entirely new artistic program. And part of this was that you definitely should not make saints into people who are superior. You know, up until that time, with mannerism, you have many of the saints that don't even engage you, right? You can't, no llegas ni al nivel de Betún, right? They are so far superior that you can't even begin to comprehend them, right? This is the essence of mannerist painting, that these people are too refined, too good for you, the spectator. And the Council of Trent said just the opposite. You have to show these people, you have to show the saints as people very much like your neighbor. Because, in fact, your neighbor could be a saint and you don't know. All right, I've run out of time. Okay, I'm going to have to take this up on my next program.
Difficult. You have to be really motivated to make the long-term effort. For this reason, opportunists appear offering easy solutions. Do you believe in these solutions? Do you believe in these easy solutions?
¿Conoces los super eficaces summer impacts de Vaughan? Considéralo como un chute de inglés. ¿Y qué mejor momento que en medio del verano? Los Summer Impacts de Vaughan empiezan el 30 de mayo y van hasta el 5 de septiembre. Aprovecha este verano para ganar confianza y empezar septiembre pisando fuerte. Y puedes escoger lo que mejor te convenga, o presencial o bien por videoconferencia. Whatever floats your boat. Tenemos horarios de tarde y de mañana. Tendrás un profesor Vaughan para ayudarte con la pronunciación.